You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
Welcome to Breaking Math Podcast. I'm your host, Autumn Feneff. Today, we're joined by Dr. Destiny Nock, a professor of engineering and public policy and civil and environmental engineering at Carnegie Mellon University. Dr. Nock is also CEO and founder of People's Energy Analytics. Dr. Nock is a leading expert in energy justice, environmental justice, decision analysis, and the energy poverty climate change nexus. Through her innovative use of mathematical modeling, she addresses societal challenges in sustainability planning, energy policy, equity, and particularly within electricity systems and other crucial infrastructure. Her current projects include creating a framework to assess the sustainability and equity trade-offs for power plant investments across the United States and developing new measures of energy poverty to aid utility companies in identifying energy-limiting behaviors in low-income households. Join us as we dive deep into the intersections of mathematics, energy, and social good, and explore how mathematical tools can drive more just and sustainable futures. Hi, Destiny. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Autumn. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So tell me a little bit more about your background. You're a professor and you're also a CEO of an engineering analytics company. How did that come about? You and I have known each other for a while, but when did you start doing this?
Yeah, so I always joke with my husband and my students that for some people, busy is just a state of time in their life. And for others, it's a state of being. So I like to think that I've kind of always been an entrepreneur. When I was in high school, I started an earring business. And then in grad school, I had some babysitting on the side and a coat business as I was going into grad school. And so now as a professor, working in the energy space, and I create algorithms which identify who is not using enough energy in their home, who's spending a lot of money on their bills, which could be putting them into financial hardship. And so then once I published the paper about my algorithms and what we created, then we got a lot of utilities who were just super interested understanding one, what we did, and then two, how they could integrate it into their operations. And that's when we said, okay, there is a business here. And we wanted to make sure that the utilities were using it in the correct manner, as well as making sure that the algorithms were actually identifying who we thought they were going to identify. And so that's when I spun out my research from Carnegie Mellon University into my company, which is People's Energy Analytics. And now we have just been ripping and running in both. So I still do create new algorithms through the research side. And then we operationalize those algorithms through the company side. And we have two utility customers, which I'm just super excited about. And we just got back from presenting at the RE Plus conference in Anaheim, California, and got a lot of traction there. So I just feel like it's been nice to see the interest in operationalizing math that can help promote social justice.
That is actually mind-blowing. So a lot of the times we see people just running the numbers and people think of mathematics as you're doing a computation for something, but seeing this in action and how it takes place towards that push in public policy really makes the difference, right? So out of curiosity, what are some of the most significant barriers and opportunities that you're seeing in the energy economy?
So in the energy economy, I think that we're at a great time for understanding, one, what are the sustainability challenges that we are going to face when we're implementing, you know, new power plants, retiring old power plants, but then two, you know, who are going to be impacted? You know, which populations are going to receive the most benefits, which populations are still going to be on the receiving end of burdens. And the fact that we're having those conversations right now, I think, means that it's a great time to be in the energy space, because the energy system is in transition. We got to build more wind turbines. We got to build more transmission lines. We got to upgrade a lot of lines. Like not too long ago in New Orleans, there was that transmission line that got taken out by those high-speed winds, and the whole city lost power for a number of days. And then in Texas, right, when we saw that winter storm come through and people were without power for an extended period of time during the deep freeze. And I think that, to me, that now has highlighted the social impact that the energy system has, particularly when it doesn't work, right? And so now that is the big challenge, right? Like in the past, the energy system has not been built to work for everyone, right? It was built in this hub and spoke manner where populations live near polluting power plants, right? It impacts our water system. And then there are certain reliability levels that, you know, more wealthier versus poorer populations experience. And that's going to be the big challenge moving forward. How do we make sure that the grid works for everyone? How do we make sure that people can afford their energy bills and that the energy system allows them to live a safe, healthy, and comfortable life?
I agree with that, because even this summer living in New England, our energy bill before was maybe $200. Now a lot of households for a basic two-bedroom house, no pool, AC running at a comfortable temperature is almost $500 to $600.
Yeah, a month.
A month. So it comes to the question, how do people afford that, and what policies can governments design for the effective balance in economic growth, sustainability, and social equity? How can we put that into place?
So with wanting to make sure that everyone can afford their energy bills and, you know, live that safe and comfortable life, I think that, you know, first, for the different types of bills, it really means that we need policies around housing quality and energy type. Because I remember when I lived in New England and I had natural gas heating, ooh, my bill was so nice in the winter, right? Like, it was nice in the winter. It was very cheap. But the problem was we didn't have an air conditioner in the summer. So our energy bills were very low in the summer, but we had these infrastructure barriers because our house did not come equipped with an air conditioning unit. And then, you know, during a heat wave, though, we were at risk. I remember getting heat illness. I had to take cold showers just to not feel sick in the home. I think at one point it was like 90 degrees in my bedroom. It was hot.
It's so hot. And even the pool, I know at my house, it was still like 88 degrees for some days with the pool.
Yeah. And so with that, you know, having technologies and using mathematics to one, find people, but then two, you know, understanding what does it take to live a safe and comfortable life? One, how do we find those people, right? And so that's why we have the algorithms, because using energy usage data, we can identify, are you not using that much energy? Do you have an air conditioner in your home? Like, are you putting yourself at risk during a heat wave or not? And then connecting people to assistance programs. I think that we need a way to make sure that utilities do that for all of their households, because the utility is going to be the first point of contact when it comes to, are you using a safe amount of energy in your home? And then two, once we identify the people that need help, I do think that like having policies around bill assistance, housing upgrades, making sure that people live in high quality homes is going to be important, because if you are in a house with a leaky roof, poor windows, bad insulation, then it will get very hot in your home, or it will get very cold in your home. So one of the things that my recent paper in Chicago showed is that low-income groups saw their heat kick on 6 to 8 degrees earlier than high-income households. But the government actually did this wide-scale study. They did a ton of surveys, and we're actually seeing that people set their thermostats to around the same temperature. So even though, you know, low and high-income groups are setting their thermostats within 1 to 2 degrees of each other, we see low-income groups, their heating is kicking on, you know, up to 6 to 8 degrees earlier than a high-income group. Now, that's going to lead to higher bills, right? That's just going to lead to more energy usage, and that has to do with poor housing quality. So I think that having policies around helping people with their bills, but also helping improve the housing infrastructure, is going to be very important for minimizing those disparities between households.
Absolutely. Now, what mathematical models and tools are you using to...
So we use a lot of regression analysis. We use statistics and optimization.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
And I would say, broadly, it's math modeling.
Yes.
And decision analysis. But for the regression, I'll speak to that one because that's a more math-intensive one for our Breaking Math podcast talk. And for the regression, so what we do is we take the individual household and we map the energy usage on a daily basis across the daily average temperature. And then we will look for disparities within this regression. So one, we want to, you know, do some statistical tests to see, are the differences between income groups statistically significant? Is something else besides income driving this, like household size or number of people living in the home, type of technology in the home, the like racial demographics in the area or in the household, right? So then we run the regression to check to see if income is the key driver, which often it is. And then we will use other statistical tests to look for differences within and across the income groups.
Interesting. So with that, how does the data analytics help us find these patterns and trends within these groups?
So I think the data analytics is best paired with the surveys and the community outreach that we've seen some other groups doing. And I've done some of it too, but, you know, when I've seen like these national surveys that ask people, like, are you spending a large portion of your income on your bills? That's one key question. We see some there. But then there's another one that asks people, are you setting your home at an unsafe or unhealthy temperature? And when I saw that question, then it becomes, okay, well, how do I find these people, right? How do I find people that are setting their homes at unsafe and unhealthy temperatures?
Right.
And that's why now we connect the energy usage to outdoor temperature in order to get a sense about, like, when are people spending a lot of money on their bills versus when are people waiting until too long into a heat wave to do that? And so I would say whenever I'm thinking about the data analytics and the algorithms, the first step is, what is the abnormality or the thing in society that I want to identify? And here that was the unsafe and unhealthy temperatures. Then the next step from that is, okay, well, then what are the key variables that would help me understand, you know, is somebody using or not using energy during an unhealthy temperature? And that's going to relate to weather patterns, right? Outdoor temperature, indoor thermal loads, and then I would expect income to play a factor in that. And then from that, we'll do the regressions and then also see patterns. So some, right now we are exploring some machine learning model techniques. We're exploring some different like regression analysis techniques, but right now, primarily, we are bucketing them using our regressions and our data analytics.
Now, if we're going to optimize this, whether it's applied to energy systems to identify the most efficient and effective cost solutions, where are you looking? Whether it's going to be types of energy to help people with renewable energy integration, whether it's going to be grid management, whether it's going to be energy storage, how do you help identify these solutions for the long
run? The energy solutions in the long run, what we will do, we will, one, look at the different interventions that you can have in the home, such as like weatherization, green roofs, a new appliance. You can also upgrade the efficiency of the existing appliance. So we will look into those and then evaluate what do we think that impact will be on the actual bill and the energy usage in the home. So I think that that is one method of looking at optimizing, right? Because you can, when we're thinking about optimizing, we want to look at from the perspective of the decision maker, right? And so in this case, the decision maker that I'm looking at for in the home is going to be the homeowner, the landlord, or the person applying for these programs. And so the question then becomes, okay, well, what is the thing that most people really care about? And it's most likely going to be the energy bill, not the rate that they pay per second or per minute or per hour, but probably the monthly bill, because that's when the money actually comes out of the account.
Yes.
And then from that, we will look at, okay, well, what are things that will affect that monthly bill and what are some different decision points that they will most likely look at? And so that's how we look at like the technology types where green roofs or shading additions. We look at like how much might that impact the amount of thermal load that will be in the home and how much money they'll need to spend on their bills. And then for like, and then, like, you know, how's that compared to like a rebate or a tax rebate or the money that they get from LAHEAP? LAHEAP is the Low Income Housing Energy Assistance Program.
Now, with that, are you seeing disproportionate environmental burdens for certain communities?
So we did do a national analysis where we looked at combining an optimization model with an air chemical transport model and then a people impact assessment model. So three different highly intensive models. So the first model, the optimization, was looking across the U.S., where do we want to build power plants, and where might transmission come into play, and what's the final power plant mix going to look like? So then from there, then we got to estimate the pollution coming out of the different power plants, and then we're going to tie that to where we might settle using the air chemical transport model. So from that, then we look at where the particulate matter, NOx and SOx emissions are going to settle. Then from there, then we map that across different demographic groups, low income, high poverty, minority, and one other risk metric. And then from there, we'll see, okay, who is the most at risk? And we did find that the Black population did have a higher air pollution burden from local air pollutants than the non-minority populations. And so that then allows us to look across different decarbonization pathways to say, okay, given that there are different opportunities for decarbonizing, like there's the 100% renewables by 2035 plan, the 100% renewables by 2050 plan, we could go low carbon, we could go following the Paris Climate Agreement. There's a lot of different plans. And so from that, we were able to say, okay, there are these decarbonization plans that can get us to net zero at different speeds, but which one is going to also help us reach social equity the fastest?
Now, how can energy policies actually address these inequalities?
So for how policies can address these inequalities, I do think that we need policies that not only look at improving the environmental sustainability of the power system, but also the social sustainability. So a lot of times I do hear politicians talking about, you know, which power system is going to help us reduce our carbon emissions the fastest. But it would be great if we can have policies that say which power plant mix is going to reduce the maximum amount of emissions in the most overburdened communities, right? So now we are combining environmental sustainability with social sustainability by saying we're not just going to, on average, where should we go, but let's go to the worst off community, make the energy system in that place better first. Okay, we fixed that one. Now let's go to the next community and let's make that one better. And so if you're always working towards whatever community is the worst off one, it will eventually mean that everybody's quality of life has been raised above a bar.
Interesting to see that, because I know that there's a lot of challenges with these government programs being implemented in certain areas, whether it's assisting low-income households, because for some people, it's just transfer of information, right? And it's how do we know what's available to us if we're a low-income household? And how can a lot of these systems have that transfer of information and these programs be improved?
I think that the transfer of information needs to be more targeted. It's a challenge because, you know, they might be using YouTube videos or social media or even billboards, for example. And that requires you to interact with some of those sources at the right moment in time.
Yes.
To see that message. And then that message has to come to you at a time when you would actually do something about it. Right. And I think that it can be a challenge with those blanket marketing campaigns because we're all so busy. We get this flood of information every day and it might not stay.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
In our brains, that's something that applies to us down the road. So what my company does is we do try to tackle that problem by doing more targeted marketing based on what specific program would improve a person's situation from an energy standpoint. And that's what we've been working towards, because having a targeted marketing, like if I got something that said, hey, look at this program, it may or may not apply to you, I might look at it, I might not. But if I get something else that says, hey, you're pre-qualified for this program, now I'm more likely to look into it because it's a lower barrier of entry than something where it's just like, hey, consider this, it might look good.
Right. Now, that really comes with education and public outreach programs, right? So how do we promote that energy literacy and empower the individuals to make informed decisions, whether it's with energy use and consumption, or if it's even to have something like improving the windows in your house?
I think that breaking it down into language that people care about is so important. I mean, even as math professionals, right? It's one thing to say, you know, if the slope of the temperature line falls below 0.1 kilowatt hours per degree Fahrenheit, yep, then a person probably doesn't have an air conditioning unit.
Right.
It's another thing to just very simply say, hey, if you're not using that much energy as you move into a heat wave, I know that you probably don't have an air conditioner. I said the same thing, but the second one had a lot less jargon in it. And yes, I took out the math, the slope, right? The math terms out of it, but it does mean the same thing. And I think that energy literacy, it's on the professionals as much as it is on the homeowners and the renters, right? And the people who would be on the receiving end of these benefits to just make the communication easier, right? We got to get better at meeting people where they are. And so, you know, I've even seen things that say, hey, are you in arrears? Sign up for this program. Well, arrears just means, are you behind on your bills? Do you have unpaid energy bills, right? That's the easiest way to say it for the random person on the street, right?
Because some people wouldn't understand what arrear is.
Yeah. Yeah. Some people don't know what arrears are, right? Especially people who have never been in them before.
Correct. Right?
And so then it becomes this challenge to make sure that we're always talking in a way that people can easily understand and then meeting them where they are.
Now, when you're meeting people where they're at with energy, with all of these variables that take into effect, for energy equity, what are some of the health implications of energy production, consumption, whether it's pollution? How can these risks be mitigated?
So if you live near a polluting plant, you're more likely to have asthma, respiratory illnesses. I mean, that mainly comes from the particulate matter that's being emitted from the plant. So particulate matter are these little particles, right? They float through the air. Eventually they come down, they sink in, and then we could breathe them in. They get into our lungs. It makes it harder to breathe. And it affects a lot of people, young people, elderly, everybody in between. So as we are working to make the energy system more environmentally friendly, reducing those negative health implications are going to be very big because, again, like the way that emitting power plants are used, like as they are retiring over time, that should make the air cleaner, right? It should make it easier to breathe and hopefully reduce those cases of asthma and premature mortality in humans / young people. And then on the other side, so that's more like the supply side. But if we're looking at the residential level, then, you know, there is this other challenge of like, if you feel like you're not able to use enough energy, even just in your home, right? So if you're not able to keep your home warm, if you're not able to keep your house cool in the summer, in the winter side, if you're not able to keep your house warm enough, then you could see your pipes freezing, lose access to your water supply, right? That then has a host of hygienic issues as well as psychological stress. And not to mention like hypothermia in the winter. And then in the summer, we see like lack of air conditioning use, especially with the heat waves being tied to heat illness and heat stroke. You can become dehydrated. You might faint, get a concussion, right? Like these are things that are going to be more prevalent in the summer.
Now, how can, whether it's countries or even local government, help address the global energy challenges and promote sustainable developments? So that comes not only with just the health implications, but we're looking at like a larger impact scale.
So with that impact, I do think having targets and commitments that we actually stick to is going to be so important.
Will it happen?
I know, that's the question. Will it happen? Especially because these commitments are voluntary.
Right.
I think that the biggest challenge with the energy system is a lot of times we talk about it as if it's one giant system, but it's not. It's six systems, at least in the U.S. You have ISO New England, California, ISO. You have ERCOT in Texas. You have the Midwest ISO. You have the Southeast Power Pool. And you just have a host of then municipalities as well. And it's not just one largely integrated system. It's a bunch of systems that have a small amount of interconnections between each other. So from an international perspective, you know, you're going to want to have like commitments from each other and stick to those commitments. From a national perspective, I do think having policies that incentivize like tax credits for renewables that actually last for more than 3 years, because it takes more than 3 years to build renewable power plants, right? And you need industry to come in. Like, we're now seeing that the IRA and the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, and the infrastructure bill, like, they put in some things in place to incentivize manufacturing to come into the U.S. And I think that those things are going to be severely needed as we move forward with energy transition, because you got to get the capabilities to produce more renewables, like, in the U.S. Like, that will also make it more feasible.
Now, you talk about producing more renewable energy. With our current infrastructure, how does that really shift the cost of energy for resources?
So with our legacy infrastructure, I mean, there are some power plants where they have power purchase agreements with certain utilities, and that will influence, like, the amount that the utilities have already committed to pay to these power plants over time. And there was going to be a cost of breaking that power purchase agreement. But I do think that a lot of the companies, the power plants have already surpassed some of their power purchase agreements, like with nuclear, for example. A lot of them in the U.S. are over 40 years old. Usually power purchase agreements were 20 to 40 years. So nuclear is a very high energy dense base load that can make it cheaper. So now we have, like, wind and solar, which they are very cheap because they have zero fuel cost, but there is still a capital cost to build them. And so then the question becomes, like, how much energy are they able to supply? And once they're able to replace these baseload technologies, I do think that the cost can stay low. It's just going to be in that in-between time when you need some more of your high-cost natural gas plants to supplement some of the wind and solar. If we retire nuclear too fast, that we might see some rises in prices. But I think as wind and solar come online more, and they're able to replace some of those baseloads, we might see the cost fall again.
Will we see it in our lifetime?
Hope so.
Maybe 20 years.
I don't want to pay for high bills.
Neither do I.
Yeah, now, I don't want to pay super high energy bills.
Right. But we also have to think of the ethical considerations of this being taken into account. So whether it's developing and implementing energy policies, what impacts are we going to have on future generations when you're developing these models and policies?
For future generations, I would say that the impact is that the energy system will get cleaner over time. Like, we're already seeing that it is getting cleaner, particularly, I mean, the energy system started off as primarily dominated by fossil fuels. We had a lot more coal. Now we're seeing a ton more natural gas. Renewables are falling in cost, which I think we will see more of them come online. And then, of course, hydro plays a big role. So I think that I am hopeful with the technologies coming on that we will continue to see the fall of carbon emissions and the fall of local air pollutants. Now, which future generation is going to have the 100% renewable energy power system? That is yet to be seen. I mean, I know that there's a ton of studies out there that say it is possible by 2050. And I like the optimists, so I would love to see if that can come to fruition. But the realist in me says I think it might take until, like, 2075, 2080, just at the speed of the transition to see, like, 80%
yep.
renewable energy in the grid. Because I do think that the last 20% is going to be the hardest, because that is going to take a radical shift in people's willingness to accept transmission lines, people's willingness to accept brownouts or blackouts during mismatches of supply and demand.
Absolutely.
And I think that will require a social shift.
Now, with that social shift, we know that our economy will also grow and there's going to be some sort of job creation, right? So particularly in rural areas and disadvantaged communities, there will also be some sort of economic growth. Where do you see this taking place?
So in terms of like the job growth, I do think that there's going to be a big amount of job growth in the Midwest, as we've already been seeing, just due to the number of wind turbines that are out there. I do expect to also see some job growth along the coasts because, you know, we're talking about offshore wind technologies. We're building out that capacity. New York had one come online recently. And so I do think that there will be some offshore wind jobs created in that sense. Now, in terms of like solar manufacturing, I mean, it really depends on who wins the bid, like what state is going to win the right. bid to bring solar manufacturing into there. So that's yet to be seen. But at least for wind, I think that the Midwest, middle of the country area, and the coast, we could see some more job creation.
How can energy policies balance the needs of agriculture and other sectors while also promoting sustainability? We're looking at land use, reducing greenhouse gas emissions. How can that benefit the energy economy?
I think the most exciting thing I've seen with agriculture and energy use is the ability of renewables to add a wealth creation to agriculture. So, for example, I was at the RE Plus conference, which is, you know, a huge renewable energy conference, and there were like sheep grazers grazing in between solar panels. Okay, so that was a very nice, I think, use case for animals going between this energy technology. It offers them some shade, the energy produced, and then they're able to just eat the grass and the weeds that are growing between the solar panels. It makes it easier to also maintain the panels. So I do like seeing combinations such as that. I've also seen ranchers potentially who would have, you know, renewables on their land around cows, sheep, alpacas. And I think that that provides a nice opportunity. I think that there are some that have talked about like growing crops in between the solar, but I know that that also becomes a bit of a challenge just for harvesting the crops because you got to get the machines through there. So I think like I've seen more livestock agriculture kind of working alongside solar panels and wind turbines. So I think that that provides a nice opportunity for another revenue stream in addition to the livestock angle or the agricultural angle.
Also seen some of the solar panels being built with beehives in them.
Pretty cool.
So a lot of the wildflowers in the farmers' fields have actual beehives every so often in the panels, and they'll try to do as much wildflowers so you can actually have more hives and more hive
that's
production.
Smart. Yeah, that's really smart. Yeah, I think like this, like, you know, multi-use of land is so important because you do want to make sure that just you can maintain biodiversity, right? You're supporting the energy system, especially because renewables do require a lot of land, right?
Yes.
And that is why, you know, being able to put solar panels on your roof is so nice, right? Because the rooftop is such an unused space currently.
Right. Now, what are some things that the everyday person can do to reduce the cost of their energy bills? So we're thinking about basic energy analytics, but how does that translate right down to the home?
So for the everyday person, one thing that they can do to help reduce their energy bills is get blackout curtains. Now, blackout curtains are so useful for making sure your home doesn't get too hot during the hottest time of the day, but they also can provide insulation in the winter to make sure you're not losing too much heat through those windows. So I think that that's going to be one thing. And I'm not talking about some curtains that say like light blocking. I'm talking about legit thick blackout curtains. Like you close those things and if the lamp wasn't on, it's dark in your house. And those have been the most useful in terms of reducing my energy bill, because again, the heating and air conditioning system is really going to drive that energy bill. I believe that I saw a report not too long ago that said 40 to 70% of your energy bill comes from your heating and air conditioning system. And so when you think about what is going to affect your bill the most, it's going to be your thermostat set point, how often you're running your window units, right? That's going to be what's really driving the energy bill. And so making sure that you do things to reduce the thermal discomfort in your home that you're experiencing and how much you have to turn on your thermostat, your heating, your air conditioning unit, that's going to really help reduce the energy bill. I remember I went to one of my tenants' houses because they were saying their home was not getting that warm. Like their heating was running all the time, but the house wouldn't get above, like, I think it was 62 degrees. It was pretty cold in there when I went in. And I just said, okay. And we had just recently bought the house, like, from the landlord. It had only been about 2 months since we owned it. So we went in there and I was like, okay, yeah, it's cold. So we went in, we sealed up all the cracks in the doors. There was like a window that wasn't properly closed. We went and closed that. And we saw the house rise to like 65 degrees. So I were like, okay, 3 degrees difference. It still made a difference, but we were like, okay, what else can we do? So then we went into the basement and what did we find? Open windows all throughout the basement. And I was telling her, I was like, you really should close these. And apparently they had left them open because there had been some mold down there. So they were trying to air it out and nobody had remembered to close the windows. So we went down into the basement. We closed all the windows. There was even a broken window. I had foamed it shut.
Yep.
And then we go back upstairs and now it is 68 degrees. So now that increased it by 5 degrees just in such a short period of time.
Which is huge. Again,
yeah, it's huge. And it felt, I mean, if you've been in a 62 versus 70, it feels much nicer at 70. And so that like made a huge difference. But again, like sealing up the cracks in your house, right? Blocking out those windows, that's where you're going to lose a lot of energy and a lot of heat. And so that can make a big difference.
Definitely. Out of curiosity, is there anything that you would like to add or think that people should know as a big takeaway?
So in terms of what people should know as a big takeaway, I think that whenever we are wanting to see what's the impact of a system on a community or people, getting as close as possible to the household level is very important. Now, there are data challenges that are going to be related to that because household data is often proprietary or private data. But the closer you can get to the people that you want to impact is going to be super important. And I think that that's how we can use math to really advocate for social justice. So first it's going to be about finding the disparities, but then the next thing is going to be about, well, what does it actually take to live a high quality life? And what is that bar that we're hoping people can achieve? And then it'll be about making another model to say, okay, how close or far are people from that bar?
Great. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, and thank you so much for having me. It's been awesome.